Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the diplomatic tensions erupting from the shootdown of a Russian military aircraft in Syria, which was blamed on the Israelis, although it was the Assad regime's barrage of anti-aircraft fire which downed the aircraft, killing all 15 aboard. Joshua Landis, the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma, who writes Syria Comment, a daily newsletter and blog on Syrian politics, joins us to discuss efforts by Israel's Prime Minister Netanyahu and Russia's President Putin to calm the tense situation in a crowded airspace in a volatile area of combat with multiple local and international forces butting up against each other. Since Israeli warplanes were attacking Iranian targets in Syria at the time the Russian maritime reconnaissance aircraft was shot down by the Syrians, we'll analyze the apparent agreement between Russia and Israel to allow the Israelis a free hand to go after Iranian and Hezbollah targets in Syria. And we'll assess the deal between Russia and Turkey to create a buffer zone on Turkey's border with Idlib to avoid a humanitarian catastrophe confronting 3 million civilians trapped with the last jihadists fighting the Syrian regime. With Russia winning in Syria and bolstering ties in Iraq and Iran, the bitter irony arises that after the U.S. spent over $5 trillion and lost thousands of American lives, it looks like the Russians have ended up with the spoils from our pointless and endless wars. Then we'll assess today's White House visit by Poland's President Duda, followed by a press conference at which both authoritarian leaders Trump and Duda were able to choose softball questions from regime-friendly reporters. Charles Kupchan, the former special assistant to President Obama for National Security, who was Director of European Affairs on the National Security Council under President Clinton, joins us to discuss the key issue Trump and Duda did not mention, and that is the growing authoritarian nature of the ruling party in Poland and their takeover of the country's media and courts. Then finally, we'll speak with Scott Kennedy, the director of the Project on Chinese Business and Political Economy at the Center for Strategic International Studies and author of Beyond the Middle Kingdom. He joins us to discuss China's tit-for-tat response to Trump's escalating trade war after $200 million in tariffs were slapped on them on Monday, and the likelihood that before long there will be tariffs on all Chinese imports, with the exception of rare earth minerals. We'll also discuss the mysterious disappearance of China's biggest movie star. Joining us now is Joshua Landis, who's the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He writes Syria Comment, a daily newsletter and blog on Syrian politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joshua Landis.
Pleasure being with you again, Ian.
Well, thank you, Joshua. In this incident where the Syrians accidentally shot down a Russian military plane, killing 15 crew members on board, this is a maritime patrol plane coming into land in Latakia, and what it coincided with was a Israeli raid with, I think, three F-16s blowing up Iranian targets, and the Syrians just threw everything up into the air and mistakenly shot down this Russian plane. Initially, the Russians were angry and blamed the Israelis, but it seems like the Russians and the Israelis are trying to play this down. I mean, Russia, of course, is not going to blame Syria in public, but I'm sure in private they're going to have some pretty stern words with Assad. What do you think?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think there will be some stern words for the Syrians, and this is going to cause a great deal of anger amongst some of the Russians working on Khomeimim, the Russian airbase that's right next to Latakia. This is no small number of Russians shot down. Now, clearly, the Syrians didn't mean to shoot the Russians down, but they didn't take the necessary precautions. And there seems to be multiple mistakes. And that's what Putin put out a little statement following the shootdown, trying to tamp down concerns, saying that this was a tragedy on many levels and that it had been preceded by a number of mistakes. And clearly, one of the big mistakes was that the Israelis did warn the Russians, but they warned them with very little time, you know, perhaps only a few minutes earlier. And that doesn't seem to have gotten to the Russian plane that was moving very slowly, was clearly not seen as a threat to the Israelis because it was a slow-moving surveillance plane. And perhaps they didn't warn that particular plane. But the word didn't get to it. It didn't start to get out of the region, and Syria launched these missiles, which then attacked the Russian plane and causing this disaster. But this comes out of a situation that's extremely tense, where there are many combatants in one teeny little area. And this area around Idlib and Latakia has Iranians, Turks, rebels, Syrians, Israelis. And so it's in a sense, it's almost surprising that more of these incidents haven't happened.
So that, I think, is the key, isn't it? And it seems like a recipe for disaster if you've got all this confliction going on and there are deconfliction arrangements between the U.S. or the coalition, I guess they call themselves, and the Russians, and deconfliction between the Israelis and the Russians. And apparently the Israelis have Russian-speaking air traffic controllers speaking with the Russians, and in this case, apparently, they only gave them a couple of minutes' warning. But there's not a lot of airspace to begin with. So you've got all these players in there, and my understanding is that there's also a looming clash between the Assad, Iranian, and Russian forces on the U.S. base that was the site of a previous attack in which Russian mercenaries were killed. So
yes, this was in Tent, which is on the other side of the country,
right,
near the Iraq border, Jordanian, right at the corner of the Iraq-Jordanian-Syrian border, when Iranian troops made a lunge inside a region that America considers its sphere of influence, Syrian, a hunk of Syria, and America blew down the attacked an Iranian convoy. But, in part, this leads from this comes out is going to increase the hostility also between Russia and Iran, because Iranian troops are in Syria. Israel is committed to driving them out. And in over the last month, well over 100 Iranians have been killed by Israeli attacks inside Syria. So Israel is hunting Iranians in Syria. It wants to drive them out, and that's what Netanyahu said he's determined to do, is to get rid of all Iranian presence in Syria. And America, the United States, it must be said, has also said that Iran has to leave Syria. So this then runs into a problem with Russia, because Russia is not going to protect the Iranians in Syria and has made it very clear that it's going to preserve its good relations with Israel, and it will not use anti-aircraft missiles to take down Israeli planes. But that leaves Assad, in a sense, having to defend the Iranians on the ground in Syria, who he needs and he wants there, because they're helping him fight against the rebels. But well, that means that, in a sense, the Iranians must be very furious at the Russians, because the Russians are not protecting them. And this has led to a Syrian shooting down Russian planes, which will get Russia mad at Syria. And in a sense, everybody's going to be, I think it's going to take a lot to calm this down.
Well, the Israeli planes apparently had attacked a number of Iranian targets. So presumably every day almost there are more Iranian casualties or Hezbollah casualties, which I guess are pretty much one and the same.
Well, they're both they're frequently work together with the Syrian troops. So there's been a lot of Syrian casualties as well, because all of these are allies of the Assad government and have been invited into the country to help support the Syrian effort to retake the country from the rebels. And so that is a complicated situation.
And again, I'm speaking with Joshua Landis, who's the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He writes Syria Comet, a daily newsletter and blog on Syrian politics. Well, I don't think Assad would be in power but for the Iranians, because when the people rose up initially against this family dictatorship and took to the streets in the thousands, this was during the Arab Spring back in 2011, the Syrian army were ordered by Assad and by his psychotic brother Maher to shoot the people down in the streets. A lot of the Syrian army people simply couldn't kill their own people. They just really couldn't do it and broke ranks. And there was a real mutiny going on within the Syrian army. And Assad then turned to the Iranians, who brought in the Quds, the Revolutionary Guards, the IRGC, and they were perfectly capable of shooting innocent civilians in the streets to finally terrorize the Syrian people into not demonstrating. And I think, and then, of course, the civil war began. The unarmed civilians decided to get armed. I mean, is that that's a fairly facile sketch of how things happen, but is it, to your mind, accurate?
Well, there's been a lot of escalation, as you say, and clearly Iranian and Russian support both have been crucial to keeping Assad in power. Now, of course, Assad turns right around and says, well, if the Saudis and the Qataris and the Americans hadn't armed and sent arms in to the rebels, they would have been defeated by a professional army fairly lickety-split. That's an exaggeration, clearly, but we'll never know. This is counterfactual history. Both sides threw in weapons, threw in support, and clearly the Russian and Iranian support has been the superior support, because the Americans got spooked by the rise of Al-Qaeda and ISIS, and many others did too, and they stopped backing the Syrian rebels and ultimately refused to escalate once Russia jumped in 2015. And we've got the situation we have today, where the rebels have been corralled into this small province of Idlib, and it's touch and go whether that's going to the new agreement that's been struck between Turkey and Russia will lead to some kind of peaceful political resolution, or whether it'll break down and there'll be more violence.
Well, of course, that has the portent of becoming the next exodus of refugees. There are 3 million essentially civilians trapped in Idlib. The Turks have closed the border, so this deal seems to involve some kind of buffer for these people to retreat to while the Assad and the Russians and the Syrians go after the fighters themselves. Is that the deal as you understand it, Josh?
Yes, so the deal today that was just struck yesterday is temporary. There's this 15 to 20 kilometer buffer zone where the jihadist rebels, who are quite numerous in the region, have to leave the buffer zone. And others have to get rid of their heavy weapons. But the jihadists, the terrorists, who everybody agree are terrorists, will have to get out of this buffer zone, which will be policed by both Turkish soldiers and Syrian soldiers. And so in some ways, it's a win for every side. It's a win for Turkey and the rebels, because they get to put off a Syrian invasion that looked very imminent. It's a win for Russia because they can demonstrate on the world stage that they're not immune to humanitarian causes, to trying to find a political resolution. And also they gain 20 kilometers in a long strip around this small province that had well-entrenched, hard-bitten rebels in. And they've got to move back into the center of this province. And the same for Assad. I mean, Assad hasn't really been present in this negotiations, but it means a weakening of the rebels, and it forces Turkey to confront the more jihadist rebels. And that, of course, the Russians and the Syrians will be looking to see if it causes a real dissension within rebel and Turkish ranks. So, and Turkey wins too. Where Turkey wins, because it means there isn't an onslaught. This terrible is humanitarian catastrophe that could have led to refugees streaming into Turkey again, and many fighters, perhaps 50,000. We don't know how many fighters there, including well over 10,000 jihadists and Al Qaeda linked groups, could have been scattered across Anatolia, and that would have been bad news for Turkey. So, for the moment, this seems contained, but that's only for the moment.
Well, in this diplomacy that you're talking about between Russia and Turkey and Syria, the conspicuous absence of the United States is rather glaring, don't you think?
It is glaring, but the United States has played a role. President Trump tweeted that it would be very rash of Syria to go ahead with this onslaught, that perhaps hundreds of thousands could be killed, and America would not stand for that. He didn't say not stand for it, but he put it in language that Syria shouldn't do that. And so I think it increased the pressure on all sides to find a diplomatic agreement. But you're right. Russia, the United States, has been sitting this one out, and it's been watching the Turks, Russians, Syrians battle it out. And I think America comes out a winner as well, because the problem is contained. Jihadists are not scattered around. Hopefully it'll get rid of some of their guns. And it puts Turkey in a position where Turkey has to confront the jihadists. And America wants those jihadists, at the end of the day, wants them destroyed.
So back to the shootdown of the Russian electronics intelligence plane, which was 35 kilometers off Syria's Mediterranean coast. It was returning to its base in Latakia. All 15 Russian crew members were killed. Initially, the Russians blamed the Israelis. The Russian Defense Ministry spokesman said the Israeli pilots were using the Russian aircraft as a shield and pushed it into the line of fire of the Syrian defense. But since then, of course, it seems as both Putin and Netanyahu have calmed things down and reassured each other, and the Israelis have expressed sorrow at the death of the Russian airmen, but they've also made it clear that it was Syria who shot the plane down. What is it at the heart of the bromance, if you will, between Netanyahu and Putin? What does Netanyahu get out of it, and what does Putin get out of it?
Well, it's a very important understanding, because Russia and Israel are going to be neighbors in Syria for a long time to come. Assad has won this war with Russian support. The Russians are well ensconced there. There's a naval yard in Tartus, and they refit their ships there. So Russia and Netanyahu need each other. They need to come to understandings, and Russia has told the Israelis that it will not protect the Iranians in Syria. It can't push them out for Israel, but Israel has the freedom to go in and kill them. And that's what these Israeli planes were doing when they were theoretically shot at by the Syrian planes, and this Russian plane was shot down by mistake, as they were trying to push out the Iranians. And so Russia is not standing in the way of this Israeli effort to clear the Iranians out of its northern neighbor. And so in that sense, both Russia and Israel have an understanding. Russia can stay in Israel, stay in Syria, and will not be attacked by Israel in any way, but the Iranians will not be protected.
So what happens then if, as rumored, there's a likelihood of some military action against Iran in the Gulf? Both Netanyahu and the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, MBS, are really itching to do something. And Bolton, the new national security advisor, has brought in a real Uber hawk deputy of his to be in charge of Iran. And it looks like the hawks are gathering on our side to do something. There's concern that as the Mueller probe closes in on Trump, that he might lash out with some kind of wag the dog war. If any of this happens, obviously it could have catastrophic results. But how would the Russians see that? How would it affect the relationship with Israel? If they're giving the Israelis a green light to pound the Iranians inside of Syria, would that extend to the Americans going after Iran itself?
No, I don't think so. I think there is a Russian-Iranian alliance. In many ways, Russia has found a new role in the Middle East, and that is supporting Iranian-backed regimes like the Syrian regime. And Russia has a role in supporting, in a sense, the Shiites. If you want to be very gross about it or very oversimplified, the United States has recommitted itself to defending its Sunni allies. That's Saudi Arabia and Qatar too, but the Gulf states, Jordan, and has abandoned President Obama's effort to balance the Iranians against the Saudis, really, and has turned against the Iranians quite vigorously. And that opens the door for Russia to become the champion of Shiites, whether it's Hezbollah, whether it's Assad regime, try to find a place in Iraq as well. And so Russia has become, in a sense, a mediator and on the side of Iran. And that, I don't think, if there were an attack on Iran, I think Russia would be quite upset. I doubt it will come to that. I think that Saudi Arabia and Israel have Iran where they want it right now, which is that America is doing the heavy lifting against Iran. It has put renewed sanctions. We just heard the Secretary of State of the United States warn European countries that if they continue to do business with Iran past November, there's going to be very steep consequences. And the Europeans are pulling out. Most big Fortune 100 companies are yanking whatever investments they had in Iran. And they're stopping to do business with it. So I think that Iran is going to be under tremendous economic pressure in the coming years and will become poorer and poorer. And this, of course, will increase the social cleavages within Iran and may lead to some kind of uprising against the regime, which is what I think would cheer both Saudi Arabia and Israel.
Well, just in closing, though, it does seem a terrible irony that the U.S. liberated, if that's the right term, Iraq from the grip of a Sunni dictator and handed the Shia power that they never had before. And it's also handed Iran an enormous amount of influence in Iraq as well. So it's a great irony after all of the lives lost and the enormous treasure of trillions of U.S. taxpayers' money poured into Iraq that the Russians should be the beneficiaries.
Indeed. And that's, you know, that I think American generals have been decrying this and think and trying to figure out what, you know, how did America miscalculate so badly in its Iraq adventure? And we heard from this new, you know, the latest Woodward book, Fear, that he uses the grand total for the cost of both Afghanistan and Iraq is between around $5 trillion, which is a staggering amount of money.
Well, Josh Landis, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Always a pleasure, Ian.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Joshua Landis, who is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He writes Syria Comment, a daily newsletter and blog on Syrian politics. We can take a brief station break. We're back looking into the press conference at the White House today with both authoritarian leaders. Trump and Duda of Poland were able to choose softball questions from regime-friendly reporters.
And smile for me. Tell me that you'll wait for me. Hold me like you'll never let me go. 'Cause I believe in on a jet plane. Don't know when I'll be back again. Oh, babe, I hate to go.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Charles Kupchan, who was Director of European Affairs on the National Security Council during the Clinton administration. He's now a Professor of International Affairs at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service, and he spent the last 3 years of the Obama administration as Special Assistant to President Obama for National Security. He's the author of The End of the American Era, U.S. Foreign Policy and the Geopolitics of the 21st Century, Power in Transition, The Peaceful Change of International Order, and How Enemies Become Friends, The Sources of Stable Peace. Welcome to Background Briefing, Charles Kupchan.
Glad to be with you, Ian.
So I watched the press conference that followed the White House meeting today between President Duda of Poland and President Trump, and it was actually quite disturbing to see in America, in the White House, the obvious sort of use of state-friendly reporters. The only two reporters that Trump acknowledged was a reporter from a obscure right-wing outfit in San Diego, and she asked a softball question, and then the Fox News reporter asked a softball question, and the same thing happened on the Polish side, where a state-friendly reporter asked softball questions. So do you think at any point in this meeting that President Trump dealt with the 900-pound gorilla in the room, which is the fact that the EU itself is censuring or thinking of censuring Poland because of its essentially, you know, the government destroying the independence of the judiciary?
I doubt very much that that issue came up because I think President Trump sees the issue differently. And we know that, his former advisor, Steve Bannon, is on the other side of the Atlantic, going from country to country and trying to organize a kind of far-right alliance of populists. And in Poland, in Hungary, in Italy, he now has willing partners. And what you witnessed in the press conference today happens in Poland because Poland has effectively taken over the state-owned media. There's some private newspapers and radio stations that are still basically free, but the big stations that people watch are not. That's not supposed to be happening here in the United States, but it doesn't surprise me that that the questions went to individuals who basically treated both leaders with kid gloves.
But when you mention what Stephen Bannon is doing, and he's close to the new right-wing leadership in Italy, and he's organizing all of these right-wing parties, at what point do we stop calling this right-wing populism when they seem to be using fascist-type tactics in the sense that they're destroying democratic institutions, destroying the independence of courts, destroying opposition parties, essentially moving towards one-party rule? Isn't that by nature, you know, how fascism takes over and democracy is destroyed?
Well, I would probably use the term illiberal democracy to describe what's happening, in the sense that these leaders have been elected in free and fair elections. Hungary, I'm not so sure I would call that free and fair, given Prime Minister Orban's control over the media and the way he conducts his propaganda machine. But Poland and Italy, I think one can say that these parties won in a free and fair election. What's happening, though, and you put your finger on it, Ian, is that these countries are now governed by majoritarian parties that essentially feel that they've won and they can rule as they see fit. And that's what's causing the compromise of independent courts. It's what's compromising the rule of law. The Polish government has essentially stacked the courts. It has purged the civil service. Hungary has done the same thing. We see Turkey going down that rabbit hole. And that, to some extent, is a difference between what's happening here and what's happening in a place like Poland. Here, our system is functioning. Our courts are functioning. The media is functioning. There's pushback against the president. I have to say the president still has a remarkable ability to do damage, even though we live in a country of checks and balances. He may be trying to compromise our institutions, but hasn't succeeded yet. It's much more serious in a place like Poland, Hungary, Turkey, where the government has in fact compromised those institutions, because then it makes it much harder to come back to what one would call a liberal democratic system.
So given that President Trump is not dealing with these important issues about the future of democracy itself in these former Warsaw Pact countries of Poland and Hungary, but is rather found a new ally, if not somebody who's like-minded politically, that doesn't mean that the EU itself doesn't see what's going on. I'm curious to know why, when they keep talking about invoking Article 7, and of course if you do that against Hungary, then Poland would veto it, and if you did it against Poland, Hungary would veto it. But there is another tool that they don't use, and I don't understand why. While Orban in Hungary thumbs his nose at the EU and insults them in front of the European Parliament and has even irritated the conservative to right-wing governments in Western Europe who were previously allied with him by his kind of thuggish behavior, he goes back home to Hungary as a hero. But he doesn't suffer any consequences because the EU still throws money at both Poland and at Hungary. Do you think that they should put some teeth behind the threats of Article 7 by stop subsidizing these anti-democratic governments?
I do think so. And, you know, the EU has finally stiffened its spine. I think you're referring to the vote that happened just a few days ago, in which the European Parliament basically said, yes, let's proceed down the path of Article 7, which can lead to the suspension of voting rights. Up until now, the EPP, the European People's Party, which is the coalition of center-right governments, was not willing to crack down on Orban because he was among their ranks. Now they've effectively said, you know, we've had enough. This is overdue. The same thing should be happening with Poland. But you're right to point out that to actually implement Article 7 and suspend voting rights, you need unanimity. And Poland will veto sanctions against Hungary, and Hungary the same with Poland. And the main arrow left in the quiver is, as you said, to try to use the budget to reduce support to these countries. And I expect that to happen because the EU is in the midst of preparing its next budget. I do think that there's now enough impatience with what's happening in those two countries that they will pay a price. And I think it's essential that that happen, because if the EU allows these countries to continue down their course, then it erodes the EU from within, because it says that the European Union, which stands for liberalism, tolerance, pluralism, rule of law, is not willing to push back within its own family. And so I think that this is not just about Poland and Hungary. It's about the credibility of the European Union itself.
Well, in Hungary, as the Law and Justice Party tries to dominate and corral and control the judiciary, there is a courageous Chief Justice who's holding out. She's refusing to retire. They're using retirement as a way to purge the court. So they're obviously brave people standing up for democratic institutions, both in Poland and Hungary. So from your experience, Giles Kupchan, in Europe, how would you be able to sort of pass out the government's attitudes and their tilt to the right, and whether or not it's shared across the board? In other words, are there still people in Hungary and Poland that want to be part of a liberal democracy and are not happy with what's happening? I'd imagine there's any useful polling, but what's your hunch on where things stand in terms of whether these wannabe despots in Poland and Hungary really have the people's support?
I'd probably distinguish between the two countries. I think Hungary is in worse shape, because Orban has done a more effective job of shutting down civil society and marginalizing voices of opposition. Poland still has a vibrant civil society. It still has very important media outlets that are not under the thumb of the government. And there are people that are marching in the streets to the tune of tens of thousands to push back against what's happening. So I think that the situation in Poland is more fluid. But, you know, it started in that way in Hungary. And little by little, Orban was able to take the place over. And in recent elections, he only strengthened his control. It's too soon to tell exactly where we are in Poland. But I think that you could argue that it could tip either way. One piece of uncertainty in Poland stems from the fact that Mr. Kaczynski, who is the puppet master, the power behind the scenes, may not be in very good health. And if he were to disappear from the scene or have to accept himself from politics, that could lead to a situation in which Poland could tip either deeper toward illiberalism or back in the direction of a more liberal polity. At this point, it's very difficult to say. But, you know, I'd say the worrying part of what we're talking about, Ian, is that, you know, this is part of a broader phenomenon. The immigration crisis, the financial crisis has led to a hollowing out of Europe's political center. In Italy, a founding member of the EU, the center didn't hold. In France, in Germany, in Sweden, the center is holding, but it's losing market share. It's losing voters. And so these are very important years and months in determining whether Europe survives this moment of populism and nationalism and nativism, or whether what we're witnessing is the beginning of the end of the project of European integration.
Well, of course, the irony is that the countries that accepted most of the emigrants coming in from Syria and Afghanistan and Iraq, etc., Germany being and Sweden, there's been a bit of a reversal in Sweden with the Swedish Democrats winning about 18% in the last election. That's the right-wing party. But in general, Merkel is holding on. She just actually fired her intelligence chief today. She's still defending her position on wanting to have a more pluralistic society. What I find ironic is that, and Italy, of course, does have an immigration problem, and there's a lot of growing nativism there. But Poland and Hungary, they've hardly let anybody in. Yet these leaders demagogue on those very issues.
That's exactly right. I mean, you know, Italy has something to complain about. Italy is now the front line for refugees that are leaving North Africa, Libya in particular, and coming across the Mediterranean. They share an unfair burden when it comes to the EU. But countries like Poland and Hungary have rejected the proposal that Merkel and others came up with, which was that each member of the EU should share the burden on the basis of a complicated equation of GDP and population, and everybody should lean in. And despite the fact that Poland and Hungary are pretty homogeneous places, the leaders have been able to use the immigration issue to essentially ride the wave of right-wing populism. And in the countries where the highest flow of refugees has happened, Germany and Sweden, as you mentioned, the center is holding. But it is the third rail of European politics right now. The Swedish Democrats did well, not as well as some expected. We're seeing protests in towns in eastern Germany where people are goose-stepping and doing Nazi salutes. So, you know, these are times that make your hair want to stand up on the back of your neck.
Well, just in closing, Charles Kupchan, at the press conference today, as much as it was softball questions and the important stuff about what's happening in Poland and the rollback of democracy and the capture of the courts, etc., was obviously not discussed, and certainly not in the press conference and probably not in the Oval Office. But what was discussed in the press conference was the idea of perhaps the U.S. deploying more troops in Poland. And, of course, President Trump did boast about how much he's spending on defense and how weak defense was under Obama. It was just a complete disaster. And now, because he's poured in $716 billion, there's been a complete turnaround, and we have all our planes fly now. They're all broken down. They weren't flying. Now we have hundreds of new, beautiful planes. We make the best planes. We make the best missiles. I'm literally quoting what he was saying. And I don't know. How is this going to play with Putin?
Well, you know, it's mostly blah, blah, in the sense that military spending during the Obama era was pretty robust, and the military was fighting on multiple fronts. It's also the case that the increases in NATO spending that President Trump is pointing to, that started during the Obama presidency. It was at the Wales summit in 2014 that President Obama secured a pledge of NATO members to spend 2% of GDP on defense. Yes, President Trump deserves credit for twisting some arms and getting people to spend more, but only partial credit. And on the question of U.S. troops in Poland, Poland wants Uncle Sam. Poland wants the stars and the stripes on its territory because of the symbolism and the meaningfulness of an American military presence. They already got some. A armored brigade rotates to Poland on a continuous basis. That emerged from the 2016 Warsaw summit. Now they say they want a permanent presence. I don't know if that's forthcoming or not, and in some ways it would cut against President Trump's desire to try to reduce America's military footprint abroad, but this is an issue of live discussion.
Well, Charles Kupchan, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Pleasure to be with you again, Ian.
And I've been speaking with Charles Kupchan, who was Director for European Affairs on the National Security Council during the Clinton administration. He's now a Professor of International Affairs at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service, and he spent the last 3 years of the Obama administration as Special Assistant to President Obama for National Security, and is the author of The End of the American Era, U.S. Foreign Policy and the Geopolitics of the 21st Century, Power in Transition, The Peaceful Change of International Order, and How Enemies Become Friends, The Sources of Stable Peace. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into China's tit-for-tat response to Trump's escalating trade war.
On a slow boat to China, all to myself alone. Get you and keep you in my arms evermore. Leave all the others waiting on a faraway shore.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Scott Kennedy, the Deputy Director of the Freeman Chair in China Studies and Director of the Project on Chinese Business and Political Economy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's written extensively about U.S.-China relations, particularly their business and trade relationships, and his latest book is Beyond the Middle Kingdom. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Kennedy.
Thanks so much.
And in retaliation to the $200 billion of duties that U.S. just slapped on Chinese imports on Monday, Beijing has responded with $60 billion trade tariffs on American goods. They've spared rare earths, which, of course, are key to the tech industry. Where is this tit-for-tat exchange heading?
It looks like by the end of the year or early next year, the U.S. and China will have extra tariffs on just about everything that we trade with each other. In addition, the U.S. is drawing up the drawbridge on in Chinese investment in the United States, perhaps increased export controls, and the Chinese are going to retaliate with their own types of restraints on American investment and making life more difficult for us. And then we're looking beyond the economic space as well to compete more on the strategic front and other areas if we continue down the path that the Trump administration has set us on.
So at his press conference today with the Polish Prime Minister at the White House, President Trump went on at length about what a great relationship he has with President Xi, who's a friend of mine, he says, but they've been taking advantage of us. And you know, last year we lost over $500 billion in China. We're not going to do that anymore. I think he actually said, I'm looking through the White House transcript, I think he actually said that the Chinese economy or the stock market is down 30%. He was sort of boasting that we're already putting the screws to China. What's the real situation there?
All of the points that he just mentioned, save for the trends in the stock market, don't bear any resemblance to reality. Certainly Xi Jinping and he have a cordial relationship, but they're friends in the way that I'm friends with someone on the other side of the world who I see once every blue moon, who I barely know. And so that's not a relationship that they can depend on. And certainly China's economy is slowed a little bit, but its financial markets are down somewhat more. But overall, China's economy is riding out this trade war basically without suffering very much at all. And the chances that China is going to cry uncle very soon because of these tariffs is really a pipe dream. And of course, the Chinese are also mistaken that the Trump administration is going to stop. So we've got two sides that both think they have leverage over the other that are going to keep pushing ahead.
So as you know, surely, Scott, President Trump is not popular with more than half of the country. His popularity is down a little bit below 40% at the moment, but he has a core support. But he's also under siege in various directions. You know, his personal lawyer has pleaded guilty. His former campaign manager has pleaded guilty. His former deputy campaign manager has pleaded guilty. One of his foreign policy advisors has pleaded guilty. And his first national security advisor has pleaded guilty. So how does that look abroad? Do the Chinese think maybe we can ride this thing out? This guy's not going to last very long.
Certainly the Chinese don't want to make a lot of concessions, and they have hoped from the beginning that Trump was a deal maker and would take a quick deal that let China off the hook in exchange for just importing a few more goods from the United States. That obviously didn't get them very far, and they got the tariffs instead, and now they're hoping for those investigations to pan out or the Republicans to lose the midterms or for the U.S. stock market to collapse. For impeachment to go forward or something like that. That's really not a very sound approach that a country should take toward foreign policy, engaging with the United States, one of their largest economic partners and strategically very important for China. And of course, those things could go wrong, but the president has had these views on China for 30 plus years, and he's got advisors in the security space and in the White House who have strong views on China as well. So they are not just going to turn and ease up on China because they've got problems, political problems in the United States.
Yeah, but the views of people like Peter Navarro, they're strong views, but they're completely erroneous.
Oh, I'm not disagreeing with you, but the both Beijing and the Trump administration are going to continue to push ahead. Regardless of whether they're right or wrong, there are other ways to try and deal with the China problem. I mean, I guess you could say at least the Trump administration's heart is in the right place. They do recognize that we have serious difficulties with the Chinese that patient negotiation hadn't resolved and we needed to do more. But the approach that they're taking is likely going to make things worse rather than better.
Well, in terms of the big bust that happened in Singapore, the big photo op that's delivered very little, already we're learning now that China and Russia are basically secretly trading with North Korea. So that leverage is gone. But I just wonder in general what the attitudes are in China. I was looking at recently at a piece that former State Department official who does psychological profiles on world leaders for the State Department. He sent me a piece from China by Professor Xu Zhangrun, a monograph called Imminent Fears, Immediate Hopes, which has apparently been widely circulated in academic circles in China. He doesn't spare, he's also critical, Xu is critical of Xi, but he lambasts President Trump. And just a quote from this prominent Chinese academic, describing Trump as a personality amplified by bloated self-regard and a lifetime habit of rapaciousness. The result is a person possessed of a prideful quasi-imperial mindset that is coupled to heinous vulgarity, a kind of shyster who boastfully promotes themselves while sullying everything in the guise of loyalty, dealing with new problems within the framework of an out-of-touch mindset, while nonetheless exuding supreme confidence. He inevitably makes the mistakes of the willful. That's a pretty, I mean, frankly, I agree with it, but it's a pretty powerful rebuke, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. It sounds like this person's spending a lot of time watching MSNBC and reading a lot about the president from the American popular media. And I think all of us, because have become part-time psychologists, because the president is so out there in social media every single day and is such a character. And I can't say that, you know, all those things are wrong. That doesn't necessarily mean that what China is doing is right or that everything that the president says is inaccurate about China. There's a lot of truth to the idea that China is really stepped on the gas in terms of government intervention in the domestic economy and society. Just look what it's doing in Xinjiang with Muslims there and internationally being much more aggressive. And patient diplomacy wasn't really effective in constraining them, and that more needs to be done. The U.S. just needs to be much better organized about it and do a much better job of working with allies, both through international institutions like the WTO, through creating new institutions like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and then where needed, using, you know, its sharp elbows and other things to, you know, let the Chinese know that they really need to follow international best practices if they want to interact with us in a way that's beneficial to them. So I think that, yes, you can go through all of the psychological analysis that you want, but at the end of the day, this is going to be about hard-headed decisions about policy, not armchair quarterbacking on, you know, the psychologist's couch.
Well, let's look at China as a rising power and the United States in terms of being able to check this power and encourage a more liberal path, which the Chinese under Xi have definitely not taken. They've done the reverse.
Yeah.
My understanding from China scholars I talked to is that the U.S. immediately dropped the ball when Trump arrived and immediately got rid of the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which was a way to organize the entire neighborhood to force China to play by our rules as opposed to be an outlier. You've also got this possibility of China and Russia forming some kind of an alliance. They're traditional rivals or even occasional enemies, but the job of U.S. diplomacy in this situation vis-a-vis China and this kind of revanchist militarism and nationalism that Xi is bringing about requires some diplomatic skill. I don't see it. In fact, when your rivals are uniting against you, I mean, going back to Nixon, he was able to put the U.S. in the catbird seat to play China off against Russia. The reverse seems to be happening now.
Yes, yes. I would agree that we've got a lot of ham-fisted diplomacy emanating from Washington that weakens U.S. influence around the world. I don't think that we should go too far, though, in saying that everything was fine up until the president came into office. TPP was a great idea. The Obama administration negotiated the final text, but it didn't do what was necessary to get it adopted by Congress. And so the establishment of both the Democratic and Republican parties let it not get passed and put into law before Trump arrived. And that's their fault. Trump just hammered the last nail in the coffin on TPP. He didn't really stop it at the beginning. And remember, Hillary Clinton was opposed to TPP when she was candidate. But so there's a lot of blame to go around. Luckily, the U.S. is still a very strong nation. We are a very innovative nation. We're very resourceful. I live and work in Washington, D.C., but I know that the rest of the country, including where you are, is quite vibrant and creative. and that if we would just let Washington, if we could just fix some of the things that we're doing here, a lot of the optimism and skills and creativity that are demonstrated every day around the United States would dominate, and we wouldn't feel so pessimistic and gloomy all the time.
So, since you mentioned me being out here in California, Scott, I'm literally talking to you from across the street from Universal Studios in La La Land. What's extraordinary about what's going on in China in terms of show business, China's most popular actress has simply disappeared. And, you know, that would be like Jennifer Lawrence winning the Academy Award and then disappearing, and nobody knows what happened to her. Do you have any insight into what might have happened to Fan?
Have absolutely no idea, other than being able to speculate that she was detained because of potential problems with her taxes. Personal income taxes are a very small part of overall tax receipts in China, but they're a growing part, and those who are wealthy pay a lot more than those who are a working class, which is most of China. And one has to, fear for the worst for her in a place where the police and other elements of the state use very hard-nosed tactics against people who they've deemed to have done something that is either, you know, technically illegal or somehow otherwise run afoul of the interests of the party state. I think eventually we will know. There's been other people from who are actors and popular figures in China from business who have disappeared to eventually reappear, often in court as defendants in a trial. And so I think most likely we'll eventually get some insight into this. I think the likelihood of this turning out well for her is pretty low.
But it does remind you that it is a totalitarian state, right? That for all of the advertising on television and full-page ads in the Times about how great things are in China, for the average citizen, they don't have a lot of power and a lot of rights.
Yeah, I mean, this is relatively quite rare for people. And if you go about your normal daily life, you have a lot of personal private freedom. You can travel typically. But yes, the walls of the party state in China, when you bump into them, they push back very hard. And certainly that's expanded under Xi Jinping, not just for ethnic minorities in Western China, but others. And your ability to push back is extremely small once they've decided that you're
enemy of the state.
Yes.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Scott Kennedy. I appreciate it.
Good talking with you.
Thank you. And again, I'm speaking with Scott Kennedy. He's the Deputy Director of the Freeman Chair in China Studies and Director of the Project on Chinese Business and Political Economy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's written extensively about U.S.-China relations, particularly their business and trade relationships. And his latest book is Beyond the Middle Kingdom. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.